This is Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. State Senator Karen Talion is taking some time off after a long General Assembly session in which a lot of very important issues and topics were addressed and decided and sent on for the governor's review. And I had a chance to chat with her yesterday, and the conversation began with her take on how the 2017 legislative session went.
You know, Chris, it was really nice that for the first time in a long time, I didn't find any really awful social issues going on. And we kind of got to concentrate on the things that we should have been concentrating on, which is mostly the budget and this year, certainly, public works projects. So I'm pretty happy with the session as a whole.
Well, I know that was the original intent from the leadership, was that we're going to try and stay away from these things that get in the way, at least what they could perceive as getting in the way, and take these matters up another time, maybe next session, but concentrate on these big important issues. I mean, besides of a two-year budget, that's always important, but it seems to be even more so that every year, every budget that comes up to be for reviewed and proposed, it seems to be more and more important, doesn't it?
Well, you know, I mean, the budget certainly is a huge part of what the legislature is supposed to do. You know, we're supposed to figure out the way to allocate funds and resources so that we can run the state for the next 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as for Northwest Indiana, I was also pleased that we got the South Shore double-tracking bill through. There were no major hassles. When you write a big piece of legislation like that, there's always language that has to be tweaked, and we didn't get it quite right, and you know, we have to go back and correct mistakes. So there wasn't any fight really, but there were a lot of working out the language issues. I did help to work on that when it got to the Senate. Hal Slager did a great job in the House, and it passed. As it went back and forth, we did a lot of tweaking, because you know, Michigan City needed to have something, and then South Bend needed to have something different. And we have LSA drafted, and it doesn't come out exactly the way we thought it. So we have to make corrections and send it back. So that was a long, kind of technically difficult process.
So you think the final result, though, is good, and obviously it got through, and the governor signed it into law.
Yes, and now I'm hoping that between Pete Fisklosky and Jackie Walorski and whoever else is up, you know, in the first and second districts, that they can get the money appropriated from, you know, from the federal side of things. And then we have the state money appropriated, and it looks like we'll be good to go.
Take a look at, if you will, at the road and bridge projects that will probably now be worked on now that the more funding is here, and a more reliable, perhaps, way of funding these projects is getting through here with the increases in the gasoline tax. And I'm sure there'll be more tweaking of this, I'm sure, in sessions to come. But you're off to a good start, at least with this initial legislation that's now in effect.
Well, I think that's right. You know, a couple of things that we always worry about when we do projects like this is that we try to dump too much money too fast into projects, and then, you know, we bring in people from all over the country who say, oh, yeah, I want to work on that right now, and then they're gone and out of here. It was my hope that we could do a kind of long, sustained Indiana job still, where we have, and I hate to say it coming from Northwest Indiana, mm-hmm. but where we have road construction projects every summer, roads and bridges, you know. We tried hard to do some things to kind of keep those jobs focused in Indiana. I had a measure that would give a 10% job preference automatically to Indiana companies that did not get through, but we tried, mm-hmm. and we sent some directions to NDOT that, hey, they should look at Indiana companies when they're letting these jobs.
And I know that's very difficult, I guess, when you take a look at what NDOT has to look at, the big picture, literally the entire state. And when you've got all of these companies that are close to the borders in Ohio, in Kentucky, in Michigan, in Illinois, they'll want a piece of the pie, and it's tough to keep it home, isn't it?
Well, it is. But, you know, at least when if it's with our neighbors, we get maybe some reciprocity with that. But if you've got, you know, construction crews coming in from Florida or Texas or some, you know, Montana, you never see them again. They don't spend money, you know, in our cities and towns. So, yeah, it's nice to have that and kind of try to keep those jobs in Indiana as much as possible.
One of the projects I know that has been talked about in session, in fact, it was kind of talked about briefly, at least by some of the people involved, in particular with Ed Charbonneau of Valparaiso, is to look not only at the roads and the bridges, the things that we drive on and we travel across, but also the improvements that need to be made to the underground infrastructure, water lines and sewer lines in particular. And I know that they've gotten some guidance that maybe this is something that needs a longer study. Do you think it may come up maybe in a future session, maybe even as early as next session, if it so works out?
Yeah, I have worked with Ed a little bit on the water infrastructure funding and study issues. You know, it's clear that even, you know, we know that East Chicago, for example, has not only due to their Superfund status, but also just due to the age of their pipes, has lead in their water system. But you know what? It's not the only place in the state. South Bend is having problems, as well as some issues around Indianapolis and in some of the smaller towns in southern Indiana. All of, you know, our water supply is one of the most important things that we have. And we need to also make sure that those systems are kept up to date. So, yeah. That is going to be, you know, it's hard to take on two giant things at the same time.
Yeah, that's
true. We
just
did roads, but the water issues have been building up, and we're going to keep seeing that.
And I know even before Ed Charbonneau had brought up the topic, the Purdue Water Institute, which is based at Purdue University Northwest Hammond campus, Professor George Nana has a lot of study work that has been done into the need for improving infrastructure, not only to make it possible to have safer, cleaner drinking water, but just more of it. And you have to have something. You have to have pipes to be able to handle that, and you have to have the infrastructure set up to be able to bring more water in, to be able to make it more available to people all across the state. So I know it's been a topic that he has brought up.
For those of us who live right up along Lake Michigan's generous shoreline, we think that we have all the water in the world that we need. But, you know, once you get out of that Lake Michigan basin, the water supply is not as clean and as ever-present as it is up by us. So, yeah, as legislators, we need to take a look at what's going on in the rest of the state.
That's important, and south and other places too, as you've mentioned. You know, the water supplies kind of dwindle the further south you go from Lake Michigan, it seems. I know. Besides talking about infrastructure improvements and continuing on in that vein as what lawmakers might take a look at in 2018, are there any other issues that you see that might come up in the next session or maybe the next couple sessions that need to be addressed?
Let me tell you about an interesting little issue that came up that got a lot of attention, and ultimately it did not get a resolution, but that's the question of Airbnb and VRBO, vacation rental by owners. In Northwest Indiana, a lot of our little communities have ordinances or whatever regulating, you know, is everybody just allowed to rent their house to vacation renters? And it's especially true of a lot of the little beachfront communities, but it's also true in Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. Somebody wants to rent their house during the Indy 500 or during the Final Four period. Some of the questions revolve around, hey, does your zoning allow you to do this? Does your neighborhood allow you to do this? And there were proposals in the State House this year that said, you know, we're not going to let anybody regulate this. No regulations at all. And, of course, some of us thought, well, wait a minute. You know, whenever you say no regulations at all, you know that there are issues.
Yeah.
So I know that one's coming back. And, you know, it's interesting because people like to go on vacations, and they like to use that method. It's becoming very popular, online kind of stuff, the same way that Uber, and we don't have that too much in Northwest Indiana, but certainly in Indy, the Uber taxi situation is coming to a head also. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've got new entrepreneurial ways of doing things, but we haven't figured out all the kinks yet.
Well, sounds like some great topics are going to have a chance to come up here, at least introduced in the next session and next sessions ahead. And that's aside from all the social issues that we managed to be able to kind of put aside for this past session to deal with some nuts and bolts and some money matters, to be sure. I would imagine that we'll probably see some issues that had been talked about, that organizations across the state that have been championing for, will probably try and bring them back next session too, don't you think?
Oh, I'm sure. And, you know, now that we sort of threw out a lot of topics this session, like I said, not everything got finished. But, yeah, we know where some of the issues are going to lie for the next couple of years.
State Senator Karen Talion, who's a Democrat, Portage area, Ogden Dunes area, representing people who live along Lake Michigan. Karen, thank you very much for being with us to talk about the issues of this past session and a little peek at what they see on the agenda for 2018. We appreciate you taking time to talk and spending time being away on vacation. Thank you for taking time to talk with us today.
All right. Thanks, Chris. No problem. Always enjoy it.
32 states currently have laws that set up guidelines for the victims of some crimes to meet with the offenders. The precursor to these programs was established in Elkhart County in 1977. It serves about 800 cases a year. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jennifer Weingart tells us, though, that the program now faces a funding cut.
Not so long ago, Robert Perry was struggling with addiction and decided to rob a store.
I really didn't think about it. I said, hey, it's a store. They have merchandise. The merchandise is insured. I'm going to go take it, you know, to supply my habit, you know, no harm, no foul.
Perry was caught and sentenced to Elkhart County's Victim Offender Reconciliation Program, or VORP.
What VORP did was it allowed me to realize that, you know, there are people involved in these offenses.
Through VORP, Perry made restitution and apologized to his victims. Elkhart's Center for Community Justice runs VORP and similar programs in schools and works with offenders on reentering society after prison. Last June, lawmakers cut its state funding. Elkhart County funded the program this year in a stopgap measure through grants. That funding isn't available again. VORP is based on the principles of restorative justice, the idea that justice should focus on healing instead of punishment. It started 40 years ago, the first restorative justice program in the country. Randy Yon was one of the victims in that first mediation case. At the time, he was a detective for the county sheriff.
Part of the stuff that he took was sheriff's department equipment. So being a detective, we kind of zeroed in on him, but it took a while to catch him. When he was caught, he was placed in jail, and he had been asked or told to participate in a brand new program.
In that first case, the offender was supposed to be punished under state mandatory sentencing laws. The judge thought prison would ruin his life and decided to put him in VORP instead. Over the next 40 years, VORP would mediate with thousands of cases. Connie Kayseros is the director of the center. She says they're looking for donors and grants to fill in the lost funds.
And so to lose that, there's not any kind of just systematic way for people to even think like that. Like, we're not socialized to think like, who have I harmed? How can I make that right? Mm-hmm. Instead, it's like, you've done wrong and you're gonna get punished now. And a fear of punishment or avoidance of punishment rather than a focus on accountability and healing.
If they can't get alternative funding, the program won't disappear. There is some funding from other sources, but it would have to limit the number of cases it can take, down more than 80% to as few as 125 a year. Kayseros and supporters say this will burden the justice system and the taxpayers. Offenders that go through VORP commit new crimes about half as often as offenders who just go to jail.
If I don't use VORP, then I have to use my probation department.
That's Judge Stephen Bowers. He regularly places offenders with VORP.
And the probation department is already burdened with other things that it's responsible to do. So there's not another resource readily available to address those needs.
Robert Perry.
Robert Perry, the offender from the beginning of this piece, is now a graduate of Indiana University South Bend with a degree in social work. As part of his degree, he worked as an intern for the Center for Community Justice.
When I met with Connie, she was like, you know, there's so much going on here, and you know, this will just give you the taste of a lot of different things. So, but I'm a believer in restorative justice. I believe in its processes, and I believe in what it does to build people.
Perry says he wants to work in schools, teaching kids about restorative justice, or with people recently released from prison to work on re-entry into society.
Congratulations to every member of the
For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jennifer Weingart.
Time to take a look at tax policies and how to plan for your young people's college education as we take time now to talk with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer. Greg, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Now, take first a look here at President Trump's tax policies, what he is proposing. Hasn't said very much. A very, very short outline is what he at least publicly announced about what he wants to do with the tax reform plan that he's proposing. What's the thoughts here about what kind of impact what he's proposing so far might have on Americans in general and Hoosiers in particular?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's still preliminary. Nothing's approved yet. It's definitely going to simplify the tax policies for sure. Primarily, the big impact, I believe, is going to be the deductible, increasing the personal deduction for everybody, where it's going to minimize the need for individual itemized deductions.
I know that he's talking, I guess, basically having only three brackets from the seven right now. He's proposing 35%, 25%, and 10%. What most people here, at least in Northwest Indiana, do you think, and people that you work with, of course, as clients with your firm, what area do they happen to fall under?
Well, I think the biggest key is we haven't seen where the current brackets will actually hit. So where they were defined before, basically for a married couple around $18,000 after deductions and exemptions, and then roughly $75,000, you know, for the 10, 15, and 25, depending on where he actually sets those limitations for income will ultimately determine who's going to be affected the most. But it doesn't appear that a lot of people in the middle group will be affected that dramatically, because if they stay around the same, the increased deductions would eliminate some of that money that would have been taxed at 15%. And even though it's getting hit at 25%, you know, same old rule, less would be, you know, the tax impact, I think, would be relatively about the same.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that this will have a greater impact on people trying to simplify their tax returns, or will it make things more complicated as they're complicated already, of course?
I think it would actually simplify it, because for the most part, a lot of people today are really, it's tough, especially as they get near retirement, it's tough to even get enough to itemize at $12,700. So, mm-hmm. you know, if you put that benchmark out at double of it, I doubt most people will even keep track anymore in terms of, you know, contributions if they're not that significant, because most people, if they are itemizing, you know, generally aren't as high as the $25,000. Anyways, especially if they're going to eliminate the state taxes you pay as one of those deductions.
I was going to ask what folks who are either in retirement or nearing retirement age, they'll get the benefits that are proposed in the tax reform if things go through Congress and actually become tax law.
Well, I think that the people moving into retirement or in retirement will benefit a lot, because, again, those are usually the people that are not going to have, you know, ideally their home's paid off. They're not having as high an earned wage. Social Security's not taxable on the state already at that point. So they're generally not having as high a state tax implication that they can deduct. So when you take somebody that's usually pretty simple, straightforward, standard deduction, and then, you know, calculating the taxes afterward, it should prove to be very beneficial for those folks in that situation.
We're talking with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer. And as young people are approaching college age, or if they're already in it already, and of course family members should be planning ahead if they can to look ahead for their future here. But there's some wise ideas that probably people should follow regardless of whether their students are still in high school or whether they've just graduated from high school and are actually going to start college. What kind of advice would you give to those people, in particular to college graduates, to plan a better future?
Well, I think the principles that you want to learn in terms of just understanding how to balance budget, finances around a house, a lot of things that we teach just in college as you're moving from the high school to college are, I guess for lack of a better word, not so much practical application, it's more book application. Mm-hmm. And it's simply, you know, even along the lines of somebody being told, understand what it means when you have a credit card. You know, even when I graduated with credit card debt because it seemed like free money at the time. So just understanding the basic principles around money and what to do moving forward would be beneficial.
Now, I know that obviously people should, when they're working, should take advantage of any opportunities to get some help in getting their 401k set up or contributions to any future retirement, even though there may be young people are starting out in their careers. Retirement seems an awfully long time away, but they should be planning for it right now, shouldn't they?
Absolutely. I think the biggest thing with young folks going into the work world, you know, it's no different than probably, Chris, when you and I graduated. You know, when you first start making money, it's like it seems like you have a lot of it because you never had any before. But the sooner you can begin to take advantage of saving either through employer match programs specifically, because, you know, I always tell people it's free money. You mm-hmm. know, they're going to match it up. But I think the simplest thing I see time and time again, you probably do too, you know, somebody graduates, they're making good money, and it's that luxury they buy first instead of, you know, some of the basic principles of understanding, you know, what goes towards fixed expenses versus, you know, luxury spending versus savings. And they buy a car, as an example, with a $700, $800 payment as opposed to dedicating some of that money to benefit them for the future.
Well, they should be smart. They should think about taking care of what they owe first, and then they can, I guess, look at the retirement. But you should probably do a little of both, shouldn't you?
I tell people, it's, you know, if you focus entirely on debt, the problem is you never end up saving because we live in a world of debt. Whenever you're budgeting, you know, generally speaking, most of your life you're going to have some type of rent or mortgage payment. You're going to have some type of car payment because cars, you know, they stop running, you know, and you're going to constantly have these fixed expenses with utilities. And if you focus entirely on the debt, you'll find yourself, you know, nearing retirement without having had the opportunity to begin dedicate towards saving. And the earlier you do it, the better performance, the better predictability, the better chance you have of accumulating the dollars you want.
And should it be wise to also do a little investments if you can afford to do so, to be able to put some money back to be able to go toward those?
Absolutely. I tell people, even if it's $50, $75, $100 a month, you know, start with something. I remember when I started back in my early 20s, it wasn't a lot of money that I could afford at that time. But the amount of dollars I'm doing today is dramatically higher, and that's just because I kept adding on. And once you make it part of your budget, once you start doing those things that are systematic, that are kind of programmed in your mind, it just becomes normal. And before you realize it, you're able to save substantial amounts of money towards your goals.
There are probably easier ways these days to be able to make those investments, getting involved in mutual funds or something of that sort, isn't it?
Yeah, and more Roth IRAs are one of the greatest vehicles ever, you know, allowed under the IRS tax code. And a lot of times the opportunity to save in those programs are harder as you earn higher dollars because you could be eliminated from that deductibility, not deductibility, but the opportunity to actually make contributions, qualifying contributions.
Mm-hmm.
So the sooner you start, the better served you are, and they're probably one of the most flexible vehicles for withdrawals of any other type of instrument that you might use for long term.
Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer with us to talk about issues involving not only President Trump's proposed tax reform policies, but also planning ahead for the future for young people that have finished high school, going into college, and going into life, certainly after college as well, too. Thanks for the advice, Greg. Check back with you soon.
Thanks, Chris.
The City of Valparaiso's Parks and Recreation Department works closely with its Parks Foundation on any major projects that benefit residents. I talked recently with the Parks and Recreation Director, John Seibert, about the department, about the foundation, and some of its big projects, including the Tower Park renovation project.
The system's been around for, I think, close to 70 years now, and it's a mix of some wonderful environmental areas where they can enjoy the outdoors to really wonderful urban areas like Central Park Plaza that really highlights it's been recognized as one of the great public spaces in the United States, actually, for a downtown area, to the pathways that connect all the all the different properties together. We've just been real fortunate to have a lot of partners and for the system to grow over the years to really try to meet the needs of current residents as well as kind of look toward the future. And so it's anything from sports to gardens to again, environmental kinds of experiences, to playgrounds. We have 19 playgrounds, 19 different parks, shelters, really anything you would think of within a park system. And sometimes our community even likes to try to be a little cutting edge on trying new things as well.
That's what I understand. I would imagine that probably the Central Park Plaza is sort of the keystone, I suppose, to the whole park system, especially that stretch in downtown Valparaiso that stretches from downtown all the way out to the Valparaiso University campus.
You know, the mayor really had it as a vision when he was elected to really have it as a renaissance for the downtown area, and it's been our privilege to be part of that vision and to make that vision become a reality. So having Central Park Plaza be an anchor and a catalyst for economic development for the downtown, you know, many parks are gathering places and do a lot of great things and bring the community together. But when you have a downtown venue, it also can really be a real a spur of economic development, and it seems to have occurred there. Last year was the first full year of operation of both of our campuses. We had an original campus that was opened in 2011, and this campus, the latest campus, our West Campus, that includes Urshel Pavilion with our ice skating venue in the winter, opened in late 2015. And our estimate is that we host 250,000 customers.
Wow.
a year now in the downtown area. So being able to bring those kind of folks to the downtown area and then in turn have them patronize the businesses and restaurants that are in the downtown area, we think it has an impact, and it seems to be energizing the downtown, both on the daily customer as well as people investing in the downtown as well.
That's right. That's what it's all about. Tell us more about the Urshel property, because we know, of course, about the Urshel Laboratories and the former business that's located up on the north side of Valparaiso. It's moved out of town, but that land certainly has gone to some good use. Tell us what has happened there in recent years about the Urshel.
Well, the Urshel family has been in the Valparaiso area for over 100 years, and they're still one of the largest landowners of properties in the city of Valparaiso. They have created their new company plant and their international headquarters just north of Valparaiso in the greater Chesterton area, but many of their executives and their family members still live in Valparaiso, and they still have a lot of land holdings and businesses in Valparaiso, so they continue to invest in Valparaiso. Where the plant was located, Family Express Corporation purchased that property at the corner of Calumet and Vail Park, and they've created one of their signature facilities there, and there is still land to be developed around that facility.
I understand the Valparaiso Parks Foundation has a very large role to play in how the community's parks and recreational facilities have come along, have been created, and certainly maintained. Tell us about the Valparaiso Parks Department, Parks Foundation, rather, and what kind of cooperation. And of course, I know you're on the board as a member of the executive board of the foundation. But what does the foundation do to help the entire Parks Department system?
Say enough about them. Really, this community is one of volunteer engagement and philanthropy, and the foundation has been our point on that for the park system. We've been around over 20 years now. It was one of the first park foundations in the state. Now there are most park systems do have a foundation, and we've been the privilege to be able to share our story with many communities around the state. But our foundation has 20 at-large members now, actually 19 at-large members, just wonderful people in the community, and their mission is to promote volunteerism and private sector support of the park system. We have a good foundation of public support, but for us to be able to do the things like Central Park Plaza or a Valparaiso project, which was our big fully accessible playground project in the community, we really need to have that kind of support. And so that's what they do, and they take on many projects every year and also look toward the future on the kinds of direction that we ought to take. And we have some many, many talented people on that, men and women, and they've created the kinds of things. Probably our signature of what they do is a Valparaiso project. We built that, rebuilt that in 2014. We had over 600 donors, 3,000 volunteers, and essentially created a world-class playground for all users, including those with special needs, 17,000 square feet. It is a regional attraction, and over $1 million was raised privately to make that happen.
Now, we talk about projects that the Valpo Parks Foundation helps move along and support. I know that the Leaders Giving Back campaign is a very important part of what the foundation does. Tell us how it fits in, not only with the other projects that have happened, but about the next one coming up that's of definite notice, the Tower Park renovation project.
Yes, Tower Park is one of our oldest properties, and we were looking to renovate our hard surface court areas, which had basketball courts on it, as well as our baseball field, which many in Valparaiso that grew up here played on that baseball field. And so it started with a lead gift from Brian Cardinal and the Community Hoops program that is connected with Purdue University. They are going around the state and looking at how they might get involved with renovating outdoor courts, and they choose communities in which former Purdue players grew up. Mm-hmm. And Robbie Hummel was a connection here with Valparaiso.
Right.
And so with that, we had a lead gift for a court that will be looking like the surface of the court will look like Mackey Arena.
Wow.
In West Lafayette. So we're real excited about that. And then we had another court that was next to it, and with that momentum of the Purdue court, we got the Drew family involved, as well as some other former Valparaiso High School players, including Rob Cavanaugh and the friends of Tim Bishop and Robbie Hummel himself, to also help give us a lead gift. So we're going to have a Valparaiso High School branded court next to the Purdue court as we develop the those hard surface court areas, and we'll get those done by early summer. And then next to that, we're going to have two half courts with a pickleball court next to it, which is an interesting combination. And then while we were talking about that, I've been talking with Sam Smarja, who's brother of Jeff Smarja, who is a professional baseball player and a guy that both those the Smarja family has lived in Valparaiso for a lot of years, and both Jeff and Sam grew up at Valparaiso High School. And they talked about Tower Park and the great memories that occurred there. So they gave us a lead gift to renovate Tower Park baseball field into really a world-class baseball field that will be completely artificial turf that has accessibility. We can change that over from baseball to softball in a really quick turnaround. With that artificial turf, it will have very little downtime because of any kind of weather conditions. And it will also be now the first field we'll have that we can have challenge leagues. We can have kids with special needs can be on that kind of surface. We'll be able to serve. So we've got this combination of these athletes, these former athletes, the Hummels, the Drews, the Smarges, all kind of coming in combination in this one facility and giving back privately and encouraging others to do the same.
Well, that's great. Now, John, sounds like there's going to be an awful lot of activity working on Tower Park here during the warm weather months here. What kind of timetable do you hope to have the basketball courts and as well as the baseball field upgraded so that you'll be able to get people to come in and enjoy the sports you want them to enjoy?
Well, we started the basketball courts last year. We ran into some bad soils, and that slowed us down. We were hoping to have it done late last fall, but we got everything done except putting the rubber surface and all of the branding on the courts. And so when the weather turns warm in the evenings, we need about 40, 50 degrees in the evening. Mm-hmm. We'll get that completed. So we would say by June 1st, Memorial Day, June 1st, we'll have the courts done. And we'll have, as that weather gets more reliable, we'll set a grand opening date for that. We hope to have Brian Cardinal and Robbie Hummel and the Drews here for us for that grand opening. The Smarja baseball field baseball softball field. We're going to start construction in about 3 weeks, and that will take several months to complete. Our goal is to have that done by the fall of 2017, the fall of this year. And so we'll have a partial season in the fall, and then we'll have a full season in 2018.
And we spent time here talking about the Tower Park renovation project. Tower Park, by the way, for people that don't know where it's located, it's at Franklin and Evans Streets.
That's correct.
Just west of Calumet Avenue. And the reason it's called Tower Park is because it happens to be in the shadow of the city of Valparaiso's main water tower, hence the
That's
name
correct.
Tower Park. So, now, besides Tower Park, what other projects are likely to be done here in the Valparaiso Parks and Rec system this summer?
Well, the other thing that we've got going, the city acquired the Clifford Stone property, which is just north of Valparaiso High School, is 15 acres. And we are going to be moving our horticulture center, which is one of the signatures of this community. I think people would agree in lots of ways, from Ogden Gardens to all of the public lands and the public rights of way in which we do a lot of things with our horticulture division. And we are moving horticulture, and we've acquired greenhouses from Samuelson's Nursery that went out of business. We deconstructed those greenhouses. We're going to reconstruct them there on that site.
Wow.
So it will give us capability to do a lot of things more efficiently, as well as be able to accommodate the public and being in those greenhouse areas and helping us work with horticulture as well as learn about horticulture. And in addition, next to that site, we're going to be establishing our first public dog park, off-leash dog park. And one of the things we're doing, we try to do everything with partnerships, and we're going to be working with Lakeshore Paws, which is a dog rescue nonprofit. We're going to be working with them, and we're going to be raising some private funds to help develop that dog park. And most importantly, then they're going to operate that dog park as a private-public partnership with us.
That's great. John, is there a website or more information people can get here if they'd like to follow along with the projects, not only the renovation work in Tower Park, which is already underway and should be finished up soon, but the other work that you've mentioned?
You know, valparaisoparks.org, you can go and find anything on that website, and then also valpoparksfoundation.org.
That's great.
Either one of those two, they can find out anything, and contact our office at 219-462-5144. It's always a partnership, and we couldn't do it without the volunteers and the private support that we always seem to get, and we're very thankful for it.
That's Valparaiso City Parks and Recreation Director John Seibert. The state is fueling up to send Hoosier students on a free road trip this fall. Higher Education Commissioner Teresa Lubbers says the new initiative, Road Trip Indiana, is being launched as part of the state's annual Career Ready campaign that promotes career exploration and work-based learning opportunities.
We think a lot of students have no idea what the world of work actually looks like, and we think it's important for them earlier rather than later to explore these kind of career options and find something that hopefully that they love but also aligns with the dynamic and changing economy.
Developed as part of the long-running public television program Road Trip Nation, the Road Trip Indiana spinoff will follow three Hoosier students on a journey across the state as they explore their career interests through interviews with various employers.
We'll have a Share Your Platform where employers from around the state can tell their story, what they've learned about their careers, what they wish they would have known, what the job actually looks like.
Applicants must be at least 18 years old and pursuing or planning to pursue some form of education or training beyond high school. The deadline for applications is May 22nd. More than 500 applications have already been received. Indiana Road Trippers will be selected in July, and the two-week trip across Indiana in Road Trip Nation's iconic green RV will take place in August, and the documentary will air on public television stations in 2018. An Indiana University official says the school has been targeted by the ransomware attack WannaCry that's locked thousands of computers in 150-plus countries. IU's vice president for research and a senior fellow at the Center for Cybersecurity Research, Fred Cate, says the university has not detected any infected computers, but there have been efforts to infiltrate the virus into the IU network. Cate says that there are two ways that the ransomware could infect a computer: if the user clicks on a phishing link, like in an email, or if the system's Microsoft software that hasn't been updated in a while.
Even if your own machine gets compromised, it shouldn't be the malicious code shouldn't be transferred to anyone else's machine. and IU updates all of its machines regularly.
Kate says that the ransomware attacks are just some of the hundreds of thousands that target the IU network every hour. So the university is pretty well equipped to deal with kind of threat.
You know, there are a lot of pretty active defenses against those in general, so that even if a single machine falls victim, you don't allow it to spread to the whole network.
And Kate says that there is no need to panic, but he says that Hoosiers should be absolutely concerned if they possibly can. And he recommends regularly updating computer software and keeping backup copies of important files. A group of Indiana University students is helping adults struggling with dementia connect with their pasts through familiar songs. It's part of a national program that is called Music and Memory, which works with facilities to set up iPods that contain personalized playlists for each person. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brozier tells us that the idea is that songs from their lives will help trigger feelings of happiness or even specific memories.
Every Friday afternoon, a group of seniors gathers around a large table at Bloomington's Better Day Club and sings along to songs using a binder full of lyrics.
You are near.
This adult day program provides speech, art, and music therapy for those with Alzheimer's disease or dementia. And lately, the songs they've been singing are a lot more personal. That song, called I Love You Truly, makes a man named Daryl get teary-eyed because he sang it to his bride on their wedding day.
That's the reason I cried.
As part of a special music and memory class at Indiana University, students are helping these seniors create customized playlists that can help trigger memories. Ethnomusicologist Jenny Gubner teaches the course at IU. She says students start by asking each participant about the role of music in their lives.
Not just what's your favorite music, right? But what did you do when you were a little kid? You know, do you remember, like, did you ride a bicycle? Oh, did you ever sing songs on your bicycle?
The questions serve as prompts to get the seniors thinking about songs that were important during different years of their lives. The music is then loaded onto an iPod shuffle for each person to use, and Gubner says you can tell pretty quickly when they're hearing a familiar song.
You just see somebody, this, you know, life force coming out of the eyes and bodies of people, and it changes you.
Today, the group is using headphones to listen together to songs on each of their playlists. And the music is truly transformative. Some of the seniors close their eyes and sway their heads as they listen. Others start to smile as the first notes play, as if they're seeing a familiar friend. And they all sing along. When 101-year-old Bruce Nelson is among the most enthusiastic in the group, often singing with gusto. Music is something he's always enjoyed. The lifelong churchgoer enjoys singing hymns and says some of his favorite songs remind him of growing up in Michigan.
I like songs that we sang when I was a schoolboy. Enjoy those, reminiscing on those.
Nelson's daughter Nancy says she knew Music and Memory would be a good fit for her dad. She remembers her parents constantly having classical music on the radio and attending lots of concerts.
And he would always sing along to the radio, and you were a great whistler.
But she was guarded in her expectations of the program. Nancy already connects with her dad in many ways, so she wasn't expecting music to make a big difference.
Standing next to my dad and listening to him sing hymns has been a lifelong experience. So to get to be able to do that now is remarkable to me. It's just remarkable.
The IU program is about more than just bringing people joy. Studies show personalized music listening can reduce some of the everyday symptoms of dementia, therefore increasing quality of life. While the effects may be temporary, they're meaningful for families who struggle to find the context needed to connect with those suffering from memory loss. Organizers are hoping to expand the program to other facilities in the coming year, and Executive Director of Better Day Club, Kathleen Weber, says she hopes they can help combat perceptions, too.
Don't assume that because somebody has dementia that it's the end of the road. Dementia changes things, and eventually it can lead to the ultimate end of life for somebody. But the diagnosis itself is not a death sentence. there's a lot of living to be done.
The music and memory course will continue at IU in the fall. Students are starting a club there, too. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
This is Quantum Leap Soundbites, brought to you by Indiana Humanities. This series is part of Indiana Humanities' Quantum Leap Initiative, which invites Hoosiers to explore and celebrate the spirit of possibility and problem solving that occurs when we bridge the humanities with science, technology, engineering, and math. On this week's episode, we're exploring Hoosier innovation in the face of adversity. We're talking about the L.H. Smith Oil Corporation, owned by Lanny H. Smith of Indianapolis. Lanny grew up in Indianapolis's black community during the 1940s and 50s in an entrepreneurial family. His uncle owned a grocery store that Lanny worked in as a child. Lanny always had an entrepreneurial spirit. According to a story he told the Indy Star in 1983, he began his first business as a child, selling his grandparents' vegetables from their garden. Though he was successful, there was the small problem that his grandparents hadn't actually given him permission to do that. Throughout his childhood, he created an informal lawn-cutting business, which he did with a friend, that, according to Lanny, cut the grass of over 300 different homes. Lanny attended IU briefly, but dropped out to attend Indiana College of Mortuary Science. Though he received a degree from mortuary school, he didn't use it much because he felt the positions he was being offered weren't commensurate with his experience. Eventually, he started working for a friend's small oil business. Not long after, in 1962, he started his own small oil company. For most of the time this company was operational, it was called L.H. Smith Oil Corporation. At first, the company was so small it only made heating oil deliveries to homes. But by 1976, Smith Oil was listed in Black Enterprise in the top 100 biggest black businesses nationwide, ranking 97th. By 1980, it was the 14th largest black business in the country and maintained a ranking on the Black Enterprise Top 100 list until 1984. But according to former employee of L.H. Smith Oil Corporation, Mark Walker, it wasn't common for black people to own big businesses at that time. According to Walker, the racism that Lanny had to face made him a pioneer.
I don't know whether he was did anything new, but he did things first as a black businessman. In other words, he was the first black businessman in the area to, you know, to break those multi-million-dollar barriers. I mean, most black businesses were small businesses until he came along and businesses started doing tens of millions of dollars. So I think the battles that he fought with political battles and battles just trying to be a businessman in a predominantly white business in a white world, I mean, those kind of battles would be battles that would be first that he fought.
The racism that Lanny and his company faced was substantial. According to Lanny and Mark, though the company was doing extremely well, the bank refused to give large loans to Smith Oil, which limited how quickly the company could grow. Mark also noted that the police would often stop Smith Oil trucks on their way to delivery, costing the company money in delivery late fees. According to Mark, Smith Oil was often treated unfairly by contractors. Employees were called racial slurs and treated suspiciously. How Lanny dealt with all this is why Mark considers him to be a trailblazer.
That's when I said he was the trailblazer. It's because of situations like that and because of some of the stances that he took. So what did he do about the Hoosier Dome? Well, we refused to deliver any more oil down there because his outlook was that we don't have to take that. And so those are the kinds of things I was talking about when I said he actually was a trailblazer and had blazed the trail for a lot of those who came before him. Because today you don't have that, and unless you lived through something like that, you wouldn't even know it.
Laney once told the Indianapolis Star that he was exhausted from dealing with so much racism at work and craved being in the safety of his own home. But if he was exhausted, his brain certainly didn't slow down. He was a master of vertical integration, an economic term that describes when a company owns several businesses within the same production line that would ordinarily be owned by several separate companies. For Laney, this meant opening a truck repair shop, so that when he had to get his oil trucks repaired, he profited from it. And he opened up a gas station.
If you're going to pay somebody for the cost of fuel, you may as well buy it from yourself.
He also opened up a fish market. But that might have just been for him. During Laney's life, he didn't just stand up for himself and his businesses. In his membership of several community organizations, he spoke tirelessly on behalf of the rights of all minority-owned businesses. He was a part of the Chamber of Commerce, Indianapolis Business Forum, and the Flanner House. Quantum Leap Soundbites is about celebrating Hoosiers who have and do innovate in STEM. Laney H. Smith, Jr., who died in 2000 at the age of 61, left behind a legacy of innovation, trailblazing, and civic duty. He's a reminder that our humanity is never far removed from the great inventions and ingenious ideas that drive us forward. Indiana Humanities connects people, opens minds, and enriches lives by creating and facilitating programs that encourage Hoosiers to think, read, and talk. This has been Quantum Leap Soundbites, and I'm Sandra Burton.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. Thank you very much for being with us. I'm Chris Nolte. It's going to be our usual Reporters Roundtable Thursday. We hope you'll join us for that tomorrow.